This is 1988 Tops, where every card has a story to tell. Your hosts are David McKellis and Matt Kuzma. Let's play ball. Welcome back to 1988 Tops. David, what's our card for this week?
Our card this week is Danny Tartable, card number 724, outfielder for the Kansas City Royals.
All right, and why are we talking about Danny today?
This was a request from listener Scott H. I was on the Vintage Baseball Facebook site and, you know, just making some passive-aggressive comments to some angry trolls.
Per usual.
And Scott saw one of my posts and said, "One of my favorite podcasts spotted in the wild. Please do Danny Tartable soon, LOL." So here you go, Scott. Normally we don't have this quick a turnaround on a request. I remember Danny Tartable because around this time, when I saw how good of a player he was on the back of his card, I wanted to collect his rookie card along with some of the other good young players, your Jose Cansecos, Corey Snyder, Wally Joyner, these guys who had 1987 Topps All-Star rookie cards. And my little brother, who was like two or three at the time and learning to talk, would say Danny Tartable in a funny way. And he would just say Danny Tartable. And then when he came to the White Sox, we would always say Danny Tartable in that very specific way. Aside from my personal family history with Danny Tartable, our deep connection, there's pop culture references, multiple television shows featuring Danny Tartable, starring Danny Tartable, you might say. He was a prolific slugger for a few years, and he has a Sabre bio written by Dr. Charles Faber. And Dr. Faber was a historian and professor of education at the University of Kentucky. Normally, we don't get into too much about the writers of these Sabre bios, but Dr. Faber actually passed away in 2016, and he lent his expertise in school policy and legal rights to school desegregation in the South and Midwest and dedicated his life to that. And he was a prolific writer of biographies at the Sabre Bio Project. So a man after our own hearts. Dr. Faber passed away at the age of 89. So thank you for your legacy of education and historical and baseball research, Dr. Charles Faber.
Fantastic. Let's go to the front of card 724. And here we have Danny Tartable in that bright royal blue of the Royals. Danny, a left-handed hitter coming out of the box. Looks like he's just put one, maybe down the right field line.
Wait, he is a right-handed hitter.
Is he? Then, okay, I can't see.
What's he doing?
Wait a minute. He still has the bat within his right hand. Okay, let me start over with that. Wait, what?
Why would he be?
Did he bunt single? Did he bunt down the first baseline and he still has the bat in his right hand?
Why is his bat in his right?
Why is the bat in his right hand?
Why is he not throwing the bat to the side?
With his left hand.
Why is he throwing the bat with his right hand?
This is a mystery, folks. I think that maybe in looking at this angle that he has just laid down a bunt on the first base side and is looking to beat out an infield single?
I'm confused. I didn't think about it that much until now, except that it does look weird that he is running to first base and throwing the bat with his right hand.
You would never see that.
To the first base side. It doesn't really make sense why he would be doing that. It just is kind of an awkward pose.
Yeah.
I'm afraid for him that he's going to trip over that bat.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, folks. What does make sense is that there's someone in the Expos dugout behind him. And you can see, even though it's a little fuzzy, it's out of focus, beautiful white Expos uniform. You can see blue and red striping on the shoulder. You can see the Expos logo on the front. You can see the pinwheel hat, at least half of it.
This is from that famous Expos Royals World Series.
I like the shoes, too, that Danny's got.
He's got some pony shoes on.
Let's go to the back of 724, and we have Danny Tartable, outfielder. 6'1", 205, right-handed batter and thrower. Drafted by the Reds in the third round of 1980. Born October 30th, 1962, in San Juan, Puerto Rico, with a home in Clearwater, Florida.
Danny was born in San Juan, a place Matt loves and that we have talked about in the past, but that wasn't where he grew up. we should get into a little bit of his family background to describe his living situation and why he was living all over the United States and San Juan, Puerto Rico. His parents were Antonia Maria Mora and Jose Melaje Tartable Guzman. They were both from prominent Cuban families during the Batista regime. When Castro seized control, their family situations changed. Danny's maternal grandfather had owned a sugar factory, and his paternal grandfather was a professor. Danny's parents left Cuba. His father was a baseball player who had been in the United States since 1957 when he signed a semi-pro contract. Then he later signed for the Giants, played for the Kansas City A's, the Red Sox, and finally in Oakland. His mother, Maria, left Cuba at age 19 and married Jose. In 1961, Jose was faced with a decision. At that time, Castro had canceled the Cuban Winter League, and he had returned to Cuba every winter to play in that league. And so he had a choice that he could either return and stay in Cuba and give up baseball in the United States or stay in the U.S. He was relatively new in his baseball career in the major leagues. He didn't think that it would be decades before he would be able to return, if ever, to his homeland. Maria would later say that the decision was difficult to stay in the U.S. She would call her parents every month. She said, in the beginning, I cried every Christmas and I cried every time there was a birthday. But they stayed in the U.S. Jose put together a solid baseball career. Danny was born in 1962, and his full name was Danilo Tartable Mora. The family lived wherever Jose's team was based, Kansas City, then Boston, then Oakland. And in the offseason, they lived in South Florida.
Danny said, I grew up in baseball because of my father, not because of Miami. He said, I thought everybody's dad went to the ballpark every day at 3 o'clock and played a game of baseball. And when Jose was on the Red Sox, the family lived in Brookline, and Jose would play catch with the four-year-old Danny in the park.
When they moved to Miami, Danny played Little League with some neighborhood kids, Jose, Ozzy, Rafael. Those are the Canseco's and Rafael Palmeiro. When asked who the star of the Little League team was, Danny said, I hate to say this, but I was. I think my development was quicker because of being around the game more than all of them. His team won the American Legion World Series with Hialeah, and then he went to Carroll City High School, which we discussed in the Nick Asaski episode, not Coral City. The developer of this neighborhood in Miami Gardens wanted to name it Coral City, but Coral Gables threatened a lawsuit, so he just transposed an O and an A, Carroll City. Other Carroll City folks other than the Asaskin, Rick Ross, Flo Rida, Denzel Curry, Santana Moss, Randy Bush, who will get his own episode later, but we discussed in the Joe Slusarski episode. While he was growing up, Danny's mother kept a close eye on him. He referred to her as the little general because she kept him on a strict schedule. His dad was gone for most of the year, so it was up to Maria to keep tabs on Danny. She drove him to school every day, even though the school was 3 blocks away. She would drive him to and pick him up from parties and never wavered with a set time of when he had to be home. Maria made sure that Danny made it to school and fulfilled his potential as a ball player. From a young age, he showed a talent and a dedication to the game, but she wanted to make sure that he kept on track.
She said, I see so many mothers who say their sons used to be great players, but then they got a girlfriend and started going to the discos. Danny didn't go to discos. He had to concentrate on baseball. I always told him that he couldn't be a ball player and a ballerina. They laugh at me now, remembering how strict I was, but look at the results.
So thanks to Mom, at 17, Danny was picked in the third round of the 1980 draft by the Cincinnati Reds as a second baseman. The Reds' eighth-round pick that year was another high school kid who would go on to have a good career as an outfielder, and that was Eric Davis.
So Danny was sent to Billings, Montana to start his career. He was very good at the plate, hit .299 with a .436 OBP, only had 2 home runs, playing mostly third base and a little in the outfield. And he impressed enough that he jumped over low A and went straight to the Reds' Florida State League affiliate in Tampa. This was a good pitching league, and there weren't a lot of home runs. Two teams had fewer than 25 home runs as a team, and his Tampa team had only 36 home runs total. But Danny hit 14 of those home runs, good for fourth in the league. No other teenager in the league hit more than 4 that season. So he was an early bloomer. He led the league with a 310 average and 28 doubles. Also added 10 triples. 52 extra base hits led the league. He was named the Florida State League Player of the Year. In 2020, RedsMinorLeagues.com called this the season of the decade for the 1980s.
Which, considering some of the other guys who came up through that Reds system, Cal Daniels, Eric Davis, Paul O'Neill, Barry Larkin, just an amazing season that was historic for those Reds minor league teams in the 80s. He moved up to AA Waterbury, presumably the home of the Waterbury Open, site of Happy Gilmore's triumphant win that put him on the PGA Tour. Danny, on the other hand, struggled, hitting only .226. But his season wasn't a total failure. He hit 17 home runs. And throughout his career, he would take a lot of walks. This year was the same. His on-base percentage was 140 points higher than his batting average. An on-base machine and a power hitter. But after that somewhat down year, the Reds made a choice that later their farm director would call the most regrettable decision the team had made in his quarter century with the team.
Yeah, they left Danny unprotected in the free agent compensation draft. This was that complex system we've talked about before that came out of the 1981 strike. The new collective bargaining agreement allowed teams that lost a free agent that was determined to be a type A free agent. If a team lost a free agent of that quality, they could pick an unprotected player from any team, not just the team that signed their free agent. So as you can see, this is the kind of system that would discourage teams from signing free agents in general. The more of this that happened, the more that their team might end up losing to other clubs. And in 1983, there were only two of these type A free agents. The Mariners had lost Floyd Bannister to the White Sox in free agency, and they were awarded a compensation draft pick, and they selected Danny Tartabull.
A few years down the road, Reds fans would think about having Danny Tartabull in the outfield along with some of those other great players who are coming up through their system. Or maybe the Reds could have trained him to be their second baseman of the future. He was drafted right around the time that Joe Morgan was leaving. Danny Tartabull's numbers, a little bit more impressive power than Ron Oster. But Ron Oster, a solid player. No knock on Ron Oster. But if you have Danny Tartabull's power numbers, he could have been the next Joe Morgan with that power and on base, if he could just learn to play second base. The Mariners send him to AA. He's playing mostly at second. He hits 13 home runs, 25 steals. He did make 23 errors. If Danny had made that many errors in Major League Baseball that year, he would have been second only to the yips-prone Saxy Boy. So he's a work in progress in the infield. His errors could be overcome if he had good range, but he was making enough errors that it was a problem. The next year at AAA Salt Lake City, he played mostly at shortstop, hitting .304, and he earned a late-season call-up.
He made his debut as a pinch runner for Mr. Mariner, Alvin Davis. His next appearance was against the Rangers. He came in as a pitch hitter with two outs and a tie game in the bottom of the ninth inning. And in that first at-bat, he had a game-winning RBI single. That's a career highlight. He appeared in 10 games and went 6-for-20. That's the first line on the back of this card. In his fifth game, he hit his first home run against the White Sox's Lamar Hoyt and got his second home run against Tom Seaver of the White Sox a couple weeks later in the last game of the season. Danny said that maybe he was a little too boisterous in celebrating that second home run. When he got to the bench, his older teammates told him to cool it. That's a Hall of Famer. And at his next at bat, Tom Seaver beamed him.
Welcome to the bigs, Danny. He did get married in the offseason. This first marriage would end in divorce a few years later. In 1985, the Mariners moved their AAA affiliate from Salt Lake City to Calgary. Danny played shortstop, and he was amazing. This is nearly Ron Kittle in Edmonton type of AAA stats. Must be something in that Alberta water. Danny had never had more than 17 home runs, and he hit 43. Add to that a .300 average, an OPS over one. He had 17 steals. He made 35 errors at short, but he did earn himself a fun fact.
Yeah, and that is that Danny led the Pacific Coast League with 43 home runs and 109 RBIs at Calgary in 1985 and was selected as Loop's Player of the Year.
He got another late season call-up, played in 19 games. And at this point, the Mariners could not keep him in AAA for another season. But where were they going to play him? The first 2 months of the season, they had him at second base in 1986. He had decent range, made a good number of plays, but a lot of mistakes. 10 errors in 31 games. The leader among second basemen that season had 20 on the whole season. The Mariners had Harold Reynolds playing second base well at AAA, so they called him up to play second and move Danny to the outfield. He wasn't very good there either. He had 8 more errors in the outfield. So this is valued at -2.2 defensive war, but he was really good at the plate.
270, 25 homers, 96 RBIs, and an OPS plus of 125. He did strike out 157 times, which was 5th in the American League. But he finished 5th in the American League Rookie of the Year voting, which was a good year for power-hitting rookies. He finished behind Jose Canseco, Wally Joyner, reliever Mark Eichhorn, and Corey Snyder. The Mariners finished 67-95, pretty poor showing as a team, but they did have good young players and some hope for the future. And then we get a this way to the clubhouse, that Danny was traded by the Mariners to the Royals with pitcher Rich Lucan for pitcher Scott Bankhead, outfielder Mike Kingery, and pitcher Steve Shields, December 10th, 1986.
With Kingery, they got another outfielder, but he was 26 years old. He had spent 7 years in the minors. He was okay, but not the potential superstar that Danny Tartabull was. Scott Bankhead, we just talked about him in a recent episode, a former first-round draft pick. He would be a good starter when he was healthy. Steve Shields was a 28-year-old relief pitcher. So fans at the time questioned giving up this future superstar, 1 year removed from that AAA MVP season. And fans later would look at this trade even more quizzically, starting with the next season.
1987, Mariners fans would see their team get 13 home runs and a 710 OPS from the right field spot. Meanwhile, Danny Tartabull moves to Kansas City, and he hits 309, hits 34 home runs, which was third in the American League, 109 RBIs, a 931 OPS, which is a 142 OPS plus, 10th in the American League. This is a fantastic season.
He was just great at the plate, and looking at that, as we see on the back of the card, we don't see defensive statistics. You just assume people are competent. Now, looking back at it, we know that one, the rabbit ball pumped up everybody's numbers that year, but also his defensive statistics limited his value. But he was just a great power hitter, and as an 8-year-old looking at the back of this card, you can see the progression from 26 home runs to 34, and if you're a Mariners fan, you're like, what's next? In the outfield, he had 6 errors, which was 5th among right fielders. In his range, the number of putouts and assists was significantly worse than league average. So his offensive value was 4.5 war, but overall he was only 2.2 wins above replacement because of that terrible defense. So just a solid starter level, but not the superstar that the stats would show. His defense was described as lackadaisical. One report said he would make the average play, but never the great play. And teammates were frustrated and thought he was selfish and only concerned about his offensive stats. He did end up getting some MVP votes, finishing 17th. And this Royals team finished only 2 games behind the future champ Minnesota Twins in second place in the AL West.
I remember Danny Tartabull from this era, living in Kansas and knowing a lot of Royals fans at this time. And yeah, that was the buzz about him, was that he was great as a hitter, but didn't have the same hustle as the other guys on that team did, especially when you think of people like George Brett.
And Willie Wilson. And sometimes we see variation in defensive war stats. But with Danny Tartabull, throughout his career in right field, he just wasn't very good. And then he was moved to DH when he had some injuries. And so there's, again, less value. And when you have a guy who's hitting 25 home runs from the DH spot, it's less valuable because there's just more guys can do that. The Royals in 1988 were over 500, finished in third place, but nearly 20 games back from the A's. Danny hit 274, 26 home runs, 102 RBIs, another good OPS plus season, 145. Provided similar value with those reduced numbers in 1988 due to the overall drop in offense.
And prior to 1989, he signed a $1 million one-year deal and had a down year, hitting only 268 with only 18 home runs. He also got engaged to his girlfriend, Kelly. This was quite a production involving a limo, tuxedo, dinner on a lake with a harp player, and a fireworks display spelling out, "Kelly, will you marry me?" That's slightly obnoxious. You know, Danny never hid his wealth. He and Kelly moved into a mansion in Malibu. They had a wine cellar and saltwater fish tank full of exotic fish. And he had cars with the license plates Slugger and I Can Hit. That is, you know, not really the kind of Midwestern team ethic that you normally saw in professional sports in the 1980s.
Just thinking of Danny Tartable hanging out with Dan Quisenberry. Not sure how well those two would have gotten along. I'm sure Q would have been friends with everybody. Danny had an attitude and an ego and a lifestyle that was ostentatious. He said, "I've always felt I'm a great player. I am great. I know that in certain situations, I can do things that a lot of other guys can't do. Let's say I do tell everybody that I'm great. What does that have to do with having a bad attitude?"
Yeah, you know, self-awareness. Not everyone's got it. Danny just thought those teammates were just jealous. And, you know, I can understand if you don't have self-awareness why you might think that. Also, Kelly accompanied Danny on every road trip. So when he was with Kelly, he wasn't getting to know his teammates. And I can imagine professional athletes, normally wives and girlfriends don't tag along on the road trips. And I can imagine guys thinking that was a little odd for that to happen, for him to make that exception. But Brian McRae defended his teammate. He said, "Not everyone can be your normal run-of-the-mill person. He likes fancy cars. He likes dressing nice. He has a lot of nice jewelry. That might rub some people the wrong way, but that's just Danny."
It's not really a defense of his teammate. He's saying.
It's not really a compliment. It's like, yeah, he does lots of stuff that people kind of find objectionable, but that's just who he is.
In 1990, he had a down year. He missed significant time to injury. He had a torn plantaris muscle in his right leg. That's the muscle that connects the calf to the Achilles tendon. And he played in only 88 games, but he'd returned in 1991 in a contract year with the best season of his career. He hit .316 with 31 home runs and 100 RBIs. He had a game against the A's where he hit 3 home runs. He led the American League with a .593 slugging, a .171 OPS plus, which was second in the American League. His offensive WAR that season was 6.0. Again, defense was a drag, so he finished with a 4.4 WAR. He did make his first All-Star game, getting the start at DH. He went 0 for 2. And watching this video, I'm reminded that Danny Tartable had a cool stance. He kind of waved the bat a little bit over his head, like a 50% of a Julio Franco stance. He had a cool stance and just looked cool at the plate.
We'll get to the critique that some had about that stance in a moment. Danny was 12th in American League MVP voting that year. And after the season, he was granted free agency. A few teams were in the chase for him, the Angels, Rangers, and White Sox. But the Sox backed out when Tartable asked for a 5-year deal. And he ended up picking the Yankees, who came in with the biggest free agent contract in their history. 5 years, $25.5 million. Danny couldn't pass up playing for the Yankees. And this quote here makes him sound like a Yankees fan. "How can you not get excited about that tradition?" he said. "There's a great mystique to it. Everyone and everybody would love to have that prestige."
This is a huge deal. The Yankees threw the cash at Danny. He and Kelly at this point had 2 kids. She was pregnant with their 3rd. They were excited to have their home in California for the offseason, but also be close to New York City. They were living in New Jersey at the time. Danny said, "I've always been interested in culture. I like going to plays. My wife and I love the ballet, and we both love art. You can just tell walking through my house. We spend a lot of time in galleries." This is like Ron Burgundy-esque. "I have many leather-bound books."
Yeah, in California, he was working with an architect on a $30 million home next to Janet Jackson's house in the San Diego area.
I'm not an economist here, Matt. He just signed a 5-year, $25 million deal. Previously, he had made $1 million a year, maybe 2. That's more money than he had ever made in his career. how many more 5-year, $25 million contracts did he expect to get? This is questionable decision-making. It's unclear how much of that home was finished and how much of those plans were finished. I did look up this area. It's beautiful. Like the homes there, you can just tell from a Google Maps image, giant houses in the area just north of San Diego. We'll have some questions about Danny's financial situation a little bit later. But with decisions like this, with kind of those statements and the ostentatious nature, he's going to need to find some other work. So it's a good thing he got into TV later on.
Yeah, you figure a $30 million house, you put 20% down, that's $6 million. You know, after taxes, that's your first 2 years of that contract just for your down payment. Ouch. But meanwhile, on the field for the Yankees, Danny was injured a lot, but productive the first two seasons. He hit 25 home runs and drove in 85 in 1992. He hit only .266, but had a .409 on base percentage. He had more power in 1993, hitting 31 homers and driving in 102. He played in the outfield the first half of the season, but then hurt his shoulder, and so he spent the second half as DH. And after the season, he delayed his shoulder surgery so he could have cosmetic facial surgery and then spend a few weeks traveling around Europe. The Yankees were not very happy about that.
Yeah, they wanted him to get the career-assisting surgery first rather than perhaps the more cosmetic things. I'm not sure what this cosmetic surgery was. Again, maybe he's just getting himself ready for his TV appearances. But Danny was a big name on the Yankees, and they weren't making the playoffs. In 1994, they would be in a position to make the playoffs, but then the strike ended the season with the Yankees in first place. Danny hit .256 with 19 home runs, playing mostly as DH. That year, he met his grandfather for the first time. His grandfather had never made a trip to the United States, and there was a New York Times article about it. Danny said he only had a few days with his grandpa, but he would try his best to catch up on all the things that he missed. So this is interesting about his story, that his father came here with very little. His grandfather and grandparents were still in Cuba dealing with the Castro regime. And then you juxtapose it with Danny living this lifestyle. But I think in this article, he does come across as very thoughtful about the things that his father went through and the things that his mother went through to get him into the position that he was in.
So when that strike happened, a lot of baseball players found themselves with time on their hands and looking for ways to maybe scratch together a little extra cash. Danny was among many who looked to Hollywood and New York TV shows to get that supplemental cash. September of 1994 was the first of two Seinfeld episodes that Danny appeared in. This was the episode The Chaperone, where Jerry is trying to date the Miss Rhode Island contestant, and Kramer is supposed to be the chaperone on their date. Kramer ends up being the consultant for the pageant for her. Some birds are killed. It's quite an episode. But the scenes with Danny Tartabull are George coaching Danny in the locker room. David, you mentioned Danny Tartabull's cool stance, and I agree. I thought he had a really cool stance. It was one of the reasons I think he was kind of an attractive star. It was really fun to watch hit. The episode kind of begins with George coaching him in the locker room, saying, "No, you got to keep your shoulder down," and giving like very detailed technical assistance on Danny Tartabull's swing. But then Danny says, "Oh," he kind of complains that the uniform is too hot. And that just strikes George as, oh, here he is as the assistant to the traveling secretary. Like he should do something about this. And he has the bright idea to switch the team's uniforms from polyester to cotton. With Jerry's kind of half-hearted encouragement, George goes up to Buck Showalter and pitches him the idea. And that's where we hear immediately that we got a problem with Tartabull's swing. So George's coaching has not paid off. The team makes the switch from polyester to cotton. And later in the episode, we find out that while the cotton uniforms were great the first game and that players of all kinds were thrilled about the change, in the first road trip when the uniforms were washed, the uniforms had shrunk and the Yankees were out there walking around like penguins.
This does give us one of my favorite memes, which is Jerry and the, "Oh, that's a shame," And I use the gif of Jerry Seinfeld saying that's a shame far too often. The suggested change to Tartable's swing, it does come up in a way that I didn't realize Seinfeld had this kind of continuity. In the next episode that Danny was in October of that year, the pledge drive, where Danny was going to appear on the pledge drive for PBS, and George was able to get Danny because he said he helped him with his swing. So maybe Danny appreciated it, maybe Buck did not.
This scene is memorable because George is driving Danny to the set for the pledge drive, and a guy cuts off George in traffic. George thinks that the guy gave George the finger. And George gets a really disturbing bout of road rage and follows the man for an hour. All of a sudden, you look outside, and it's dark. It's nighttime. He's followed him to a gas station, and he starts accosting him. And the guy turns around and says, "Hey, is that Danny Tartable you're in your car?" As if he just like recognized Danny Tartable immediately. He said, "Oh, I really would love to meet him." And it turned out the guy had not given George the finger on purpose. It's just that his left hand was in a full cast and his finger was sticking up from that. And so George was made to look like an incredible fool.
I'm not sure even looking at all of these baseball cards I had of Danny Tartable that I would recognize him at a gas station, sitting in a car. I believe Danny was also eating a donut with a fork and knife in this episode. Recently on a podcast, Danny praised Jason Alexander for coaching him through the scenes. He did say that Michael Richards was just like Kramer, even not while doing their scenes. That same year, Danny was on an episode of Married with Children. Al Bundy and his group of men's rights activists or something, no ma'am, decide that they're going to break into Wrigley Field because the strike is going on. Afterwards, Joe Morgan comes out to interview him with cameraman Mike Piazza. You also have noted Ford truck rapper Brett Saberhagen delivering pizzas. And when Brett Saberhagen is delivering the pizza, Danny Tartable shows up as a mall cop.
Kelly, it's Brett Saberhagen.
Well, then why does his name tag say Bobby Bonilla?
He called in sick.
Hey, Saberhagen, is that your pizza truck in the red zone?
Come on, Tartable. If I don't get this pizza here in 30 minutes, they'll take it out of my check.
At least you get a check. I get paid in mall dollars.
Danny, can I bribe you with a pizza?
Let me check my security guard handbook. Yep.
Hey, wait a minute. That's our pizza.
Tell it to the commissioner.
Frank Thomas just standing there spinning the newspapers, proving why he didn't ever get huge national ad campaigns like Ken Griffey Jr. He was not a great actor. Al Bundy and the guys start a baseball league with teams sponsored by strip clubs. You get the gist.
Yeah, it just shows Danny Tartable's range, though, going from a role in High Society all the way down to Married with Children.
This also is a side of my childhood growing up, that my family watched Married with Children as a family. I did not watch Seinfeld. Like, no one in my family watched Seinfeld. So if you are wondering the level of sophistication that I have in my comedic interests, I was a Married with Children kid.
My family was a Seinfeld family through and through. Married with Children would have gotten turned off immediately. My mother was greatly offended by Married with Children.
Rightfully so. Having just watched an episode of this, it's not a good program.
I have a podcast about 1980s TV called Vandalay Industries. And, you know, base humor goes back all the way to Shakespeare. You know, you can't have the fine poetry without having the barroom fights, the body humor. I can respect Married with Children for the satire, but it's crass, no doubt about it. The strike ends before the 1995 season starts. George Steinbrenner wants to trade Danny, but because of his contract, they weren't able to trade him. He's got a $5 million a year contract. And even when the Yankees offered to eat $2 million of his contract, that was still too high a price to pay. And that high salary really weighed on Danny. He hit only 224 in 59 games in 1995.
Fans were frustrated with his performance. They started booing him. Danny thought that Steinbrenner was behind the booing. Steinbrenner was publicly embarrassing Danny and saying things about him. So then Danny started demanding a trade. And management were like, we're trying to trade you. Trust us. We don't want you here anymore. Finally, in July, they figured something out. They send Danny to Oakland in exchange for Ruben Sierra and minor league pitcher Jason Beverlin. After the trade, Danny let loose on Steinbrenner. He said, I feel like I've been released from jail. I'd still be there if it weren't for George. I had no problems with anyone else. But when you've got an owner like him, he makes it impossible to play up to your capabilities. Why would an owner keep downgrading his own product? It'd be like Lee Iacocca telling people not to buy cars. That's just stupid. He's an idiot for doing that. This is the first Lee Iacocca appearance on the podcast. Danny played only 24 games in Oakland. On the year, he hit a combined 236 with 8 homers, so he had a better average in Oakland. But this was by far the worst season of his career. Prior to 1996, he's traded to the White Sox. And I do have fond memories of that one season of Danny Tartabull with the White Sox. This team had something that I don't remember seeing as a kid, which was multiple power hitters hitting over 20 home runs. So you had Danny Tartabull, Frank Thomas, Harold Baines was on the team and playing well, Robin Ventura, all hit over 20 home runs. Danny hit 27, drove in 101. He did hit only 254, but this is definitely an improvement and a return to form after that terrible 1995 season.
Yeah, and scoring only 58 runs, that is odd. That is an anomaly for sure. Only two players in history have scored fewer runs while driving in over 100. Albert Pujols scored only 53 runs in 2017 while driving in 101. And Vic Wirtz scored 45 while driving in 103 for the 1960 Red Sox. I guess what I would assume is that a player later on in their career without much speed might be much more likely to have high RBIs but lowest runs scored. But we do see here that who followed him in the lineup might have made the biggest difference.
Ron Karkovice. When you have a catcher behind you hitting 220, and because they had all those power hitters and good on base percentage guys like Tony Phillips higher up in the lineup, at the bottom of the lineup, you just have Ozzie Guillen, Ron Karkovice. So even when Danny's getting on base, not a lot of hits behind him.
After the 1996 season, the White Sox wanted to re-sign Danny for a reduced salary, but Danny didn't want that, so he explored other options. One of the few teams that made an offer was the Phillies. His old manager, Hal McRae, was there and put in a word. And Danny signed for $2 million. All right. But opening day, he fouled a pitch off his foot. He thought it was a bruise and played a couple more games, but it turned out that it was a fracture. And he only played in 3 games that season, going 0-for-7 with 4 walks.
He's a free agent again after that season. He had a minor league offer from the Padres, but he turned it down and decided to call it a career.
So closing the book on Danny Tartabull, 14 seasons in the major leagues, 1,406 games played. He had a .273 batting average with 262 home runs, 925 RBIs, and an OPS plus of 133. 1 All-Star appearance, 2 Seinfeld appearances, 1 Married with Children appearance. How about hated to face and loved to face?
He said Jamie Moyer gave him fits. In this interview, he said, most people want me to say Roger Clemens or Randy Johnson or Pedro, but it was guys who didn't want to give in. I'm in a fastball count and they're throwing changeups. The numbers say that against Jamie Moyer, he went 5-for-21. So not great, but he did have 4 doubles of those 5 hits. So when he did make contact, it was for extra bases. He went 10-for-55 against Clemens. A 182 average with a 542 OPS, so didn't get on base or hit for a lot of power against Roger Clemens. He hit well against Dave Stewart, 6 home runs. That was the most against any pitcher, and he hit .386. Also, another guy who gave up 6 home runs to Danny Tartabull, Burt Blyleven. He hit really well against Roy Smith, who pitched for Cleveland, Minnesota, and Baltimore. He went 8-for-15. 4 of those 8 hits were home runs.
How about in retirement?
I couldn't find a lot about jobs that Danny did in retirement. He laid pretty low, moved to California, and he wasn't really in the news for a decade. And then he was, for bad reasons.
Yeah, it's kind of like nowadays on Twitter when you don't want the main subject of Twitter to be you.
When your name shows up under trending, and you're Danny Tartable in 2017, it's not going to be good. Danny had four kids. We referenced a couple of them earlier, two older kids, Danica and Danny Jr. They were born before moving to New York. And then he had two more sons, Zach, who would go on to become a model, and his youngest son, Quentin, who played football at Cal Berkeley. Interesting note on Quentin's Cal bio. Under his family history, it says he's the son of Kelly Tartable, talks about his uncle who played basketball at Cal with Jason Kidd, his aunt who graduated honor roll from Cal, and nothing about his dad. That's because around this time, Danny was estranged from his wife, and Danny had a difficult relationship with his kids. In 2007, Danny and Kelly split up. A judge ordered Danny to pay child support to Zach and Quentin because his other two kids were by this point adults. Danny fell behind in his payments, and in 2011, he entered a no-contest plea to charges that he willfully disobeyed the court order to pay that child support. At this point, he owed $276,000. Danny was placed on probation, but he violated the terms of that probation, and on May 2nd, 2012, he was sentenced to 180 days in Los Angeles County Jail. When he failed to report, the court issued a warrant for his arrest, with bail set at $200,000. And then, for 5 years, he was gone. He was on the LA County Most Wanted list. And then on July 24th, 2017, one NBC Sports article calls this the dumbest fugitive alive move. Danny called the police to report that his car had been broken into. When the cops arrived, they put his name into the system and they saw an active warrant and arrested him. So for 5 years, he had somehow avoided the police. Nobody ever ran his name. I don't know that he was actively hiding, but he just wasn't a public person. And so then he gets arrested. From the looks of social media and other things, that it seems like he's reconciled with his kids. He does have a more public persona. He showed up on podcasts. He has social media accounts. And so I think that he's figured out his debts and paid those off and is in a better place with his family. But for a while, he was the most wanted deadbeat dad in Los Angeles County.
Well, that's quite a turn for this story to take. But David, when we saw this card as kids and we see here's this up-and-coming power hitter, then the story continues 30 years later with him being the dumbest fugitive alive. What are we supposed to think now?
Hopefully there was no irreparable damage to the relationship with his kids, and hopefully they're working through that. So maybe let's just leave that part there. It's a sad story, as breakups are and as child support issues are, so I hope that he's got that figured out. But Danny's career was probably not what he expected it to be. I think that Danny had these high expectations that he had boundless potential. And looking at these cards and looking at his lines in the minor leagues, there's no question that if Danny Tartable had played infield and been able to competently play second base and hit 30 home runs a year, we'd be talking about him in the Hall of Fame. He would be like Ryan Sandberg. Nobody in the 80s was hitting that, except Ryan Sandberg, and Lou Whitaker would hit 20 home runs, and we talked about him and how he should be in the Hall of Fame. He had a combination of power and on base, but Seattle gave up on the infield experiment and moved him to the outfield. He wanted attention when he was overshadowed in Kansas City by George Brett and Bo Jackson. His 1987 Topps card, that all-star rookie, just says this is going to be a great player. And then this 1987 stat line, he's on the verge of superstardom. He just didn't keep that production up. Initially, his offensive skills were able to overshadow the defensive weaknesses, but he also had some injury issues, and there was a long stretch where he was unable to play a full season. He went to New York and wanted to be the big guy, wanted to experience the culture, and that gave him that opportunity that I think a lot of people remember him for on Seinfeld. People who maybe might have forgotten about this once great slugger who had had a disappointing time for some disappointing Yankees teams. And he also never played in the playoffs. So if he had been able to play in the playoffs in 1994, win a World Series, that might have changed the way that people think now about Danny Tartable. He just missed the window. If he had stayed with Seattle, maybe he would have been on the team with Griffey, Edgar, Randy Johnson, maybe if he had stuck around. He got to Kansas City a little bit too late for their World Series years, and a little bit too early for the Yankees World Series years. So he just missed some great moments with those teams. And so he was a very good player on some mediocre teams. All time among regular outfielders. Offensively, offensive war, he's ranked right around David Justice, Adam Dunn, George Hendrick, Lonnie Smith, Alfonso Soriano, some great players, home run champ type hitters. From 1986 to 96, he was 7th in home runs, 11th in RBIs, and his 133 OPS plus was 29th, just behind Tony Gwynn, Wade Boggs, tied with Juan Gonzalez and Rafael Palmeiro. But defensively, he's one of the worst outfielders of all time, 11th worst all time in defensive war. So as a player, he was limited, but great in those short stretches. But he has this interesting family story that I think could almost be a movie. His father, who chose baseball over returning to his home country, came to America, made a better life for his children, and his son surpassed his father in athletic achievement, but wanted more and chased wealth and fame and money, made TV appearances, only to get in trouble with the law and be a fugitive for failing to take care of his own kids. And so he has both an interesting career and an interesting personal story that hopefully has another arc of redemption.
It's quite a ride, just a very deep story. So thank you, David, for this today. And thank you to you at home. If your clothes are experiencing a bit of shrinkage, just tell us all about it on Twitter. We're at Tops1988. Thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week.